Maureen admits the original system left many people feeling left out of the format, but he maintains that professionals should be allowed to make decisions about the broadcast. WBAI 99.5 FM. 1 year after KPFK's maiden broadcast, Pacifica's reach extends to the East Coast. A gift from philanthropist Louis Schweitzer, the station was welcomed onto the airwaves by then-Governor Nelson Rockefeller, Mayor Robert Wagner Jr., and Attorney General Louis Lefkowitz. In keeping with the Pacifica tradition of bodacious, innovative, in-your-face programming, WBAI was the first station to air the expose of J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI. Carolyn Goodman is the widow of Pacifica Board President Robert Goodman and a former WBAI lab chairman. When Bob died suddenly in 1969 of a brain hemorrhage, Carolyn felt it her duty to fulfill her husband's mission at Pacifica and became vice president of the foundation. Today, she recalls the candidness of the early days of WBAI programming.
What stands out in my mind is the openness and the honesty and the fact that when there were people who were interviewed on the air, there wasn't the kind of censorship that you would find. For example, even on places like public radio, that people could say what was on their minds. And, of course, there were times they said things that perhaps shouldn't have been said on the air or used language, and we got into trouble about that. I think that, and of course the listeners were self-selective, but there were a wonderful group of people, both the listeners and the programmers, and programs were exciting, and all different kinds of programs, whether it was music, whether it was drama, whether it was current affairs, and I can't give you the names of the programs, but I can tell you that it was pretty exciting to listen to. Just as today, and there was a time, as I don't have to tell you, in the not too long ago past, when the station was pretty darn boring.
2 years after the station was on the air, Pacifica was training volunteers to travel south for coverage of the awakening of the civil rights movement. Bob and Carolyn Goodman had three sons, and Andrew was among the trainees going south.
Andy was really the most political of the three boys, and he was at Queens College when Aaron Henry and Fannie Lou Hamer came and asked for volunteers to go to Mississippi. So he came home and said, Mom, he had to get our permission because he wasn't 21. He was only 20, and unless you were 21, you had to get your parents' permission. And, you know, I really gulped a lot of times. But how could we have raised our kids and lived the way we did and been activists from the time we were in college? That's how I met my husband. We were organizing farmers in Ithaca at Cornell. That's how we met. And so were we going to say to our son, well, you know, it sounds good to talk about it, but, I mean, doing it, no way. But I knew, we both knew, we all knew how dangerous it was to go down south. But, of course, we let him go. So down he went. He went out to Ohio, to you know, where they were went to Oxford, Ohio, to the learn all what they learned out there, and then drove down to Mississippi much before they were finished with their training, because the church burned, and he went down with Nicky Schwerner and James Chaney, and he wasn't there for 24 hours before he was murdered. I mean, not 24 hours. So it's, you know, it's the kind of pain that, well, it's always.
Yeah.
For anybody who ever lost a child, it's always there. But it's the kind for me that has helped me to go on. It sounds strange, I think, doesn't it?
The Goodman-Schwerner-Cheney case is a pivotal part of civil rights history. In 1965, while America was at war with Vietnam, the first reporter to cover the war from North Vietnam was WBAI reporter Chris Koch. And 4 years later, Pacifica was the only news organization willing to break Seymour Hersh's story of the My Lai massacre, exposing the atrocities committed by the U.S. troops in Vietnam. A couple of years later, Carolyn takes a liking to another young Goodman in the WBAI scene, station manager Ed Goodman, the only son of the wealthy family that owned Bergdorf Goodman, an upscale Fifth Avenue department store.
Ed Goodman is the only son of a very wealthy family who had a big place in New York City called Bergdorf Goodman. Bergdorf Goodman is no longer in business, but it was one of the most upscale department stores on Fifth Avenue. And he went to college with a man by the name of Paul Gorman. And Paul Gorman was a staff person at Pacifica, at WBAI, and he recommended Ed for a job. And Ed was a bit of a maverick, and he had been working with a man by the name of Ramsey Clark, whose name may be familiar to you, at Bedford-Stuyvesant at the time. And we were looking for a manager, and Paul said, "I think I have someone for you. His name is Ed Goodman," and I didn't know who he was. So he came to my house, and I was the chair of BAI at the time. So this man came in, and I said, and he didn't tell me who he was, but I liked him immediately. He was exceptionally bright. And I said, "Well, I don't know who you are, but and I hope you don't get mixed up because we have the same name, but and I should tell you that we don't pay very much." He said, "Well, sounds very interesting, and I'd like the job." And it was the time of Attica, mm-hmm. the prison rising. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So he took the job. And it was shortly afterwards that he went to prison, Ed Goodman. He went to prison because he refused to give up the tapes. We had taped the Attica uprising. And the house, I don't forget who it was, wanted the tapes because they could tell from the voice who were some of the leaders there. Ed refused to give up the tapes. That's and right. So he went to prison. He went to Men's House of Detention, New York. Well, you can imagine the furor of this.
To the people of the United States of America. First of all, we want it to be known that in the past we have had some very, very treacherous experiences with the Department of Correction in New York State. They have promised us many things, and they have given us nothing except more of what we already got. Brutalization, murder inside this penitentiary. We do not intend to accept or allow ourselves to accept this situation again.
Ed Goodman currently works for the Milestone Venture Partners. Carolyn Goodman advises the bylaws revisionist that risk-taking is an integral part of Pacifica's rich history and seems to urge them to avoid the mundane.
I think it's bound to happen when you have creative artists working in under certain kinds of stress, whether it has to do with economic, whether it has to do with political or other kinds of stress. It's bound to occur. You're in a, it's like a, putting a pot of water on the stove and you turn the heat up. You get, you know, all kinds of, you get it boiling and out of it comes creativity, but also comes a certain explosion, you know, at times. And it's like everything else. You're taking risks, you're taking chances, and you, some good comes out of it, and sometimes you get into trouble. That's the risk of Pacifica. It always was.
I was the homosexual guy that was going to get all the queers in trouble.
KPFT co-founder Ray Hill. When KPFT 90.1 FM went on the air as the Fourth Pacifica sister station in Houston, Texas in February of 1970, it was a dream come true for Larry Lee and Dave Gardner. Ray Hill had helped to raise the transmitter money through a direct mail campaign. But unlike the auspicious opening day of WBAI, KPFT's maiden year was less than cordial. The station was bombed off the air twice by the Ku Klux Klan. The mission was to bring in the voices of all those excluded from Houston's mainstream media. They did outreach to African-American, Hispanic, and women's groups. Hill remembers driving around in a pickup truck with a megaphone, informing people that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was coming to Houston. The mainstream media had refused to cover the story.
You don't really understand how extreme media exclusion can be until you think of a little bit earlier in the 60s. Dr. Martin Luther King came to Houston, and there was a news blackout prior to his coming. We couldn't even get an announcement on primarily black commercial radio stations that Dr. King was coming, because the establishment here didn't want news that this black radical person was coming into Houston and would draw a crowd and create a rabble. And so to promote Dr. King's coming, we had to get in pickup trucks with sound systems and drive up and down black neighborhoods in Houston making the announcement over amplifier. And several of us got arrested for doing that because police got us for operating sound equipment without a permit. But that's what it's like to live in a media-controlled environment where your voice is simply not going to be heard.
Hill is currently a programmer on KPFT, host of the popular Prison Show. In a city where inmates are denied basic telephone privileges, Hill's show fills a huge void, providing a public service in the truest sense.
That radio show is as well known as it is, not because of anything that I do. It's because of those very compelling voices of lovers, fathers, mothers and grandmothers, mostly women's voices and a lot of children's voices. You see, when you're in prison, you don't get to hear children's voices.
Hill has had to toe the line over the years, opting to self-censor his show rather than face the wrath of managers.
I conformed to the demands of keeping my programming in line so that it didn't jeopardize the service I provide prison families.
And what did that mean, keeping your program in line?
Well, no one ever said, don't do this or don't do that, but I avoided angering the political establishment. I toned down, it was very subtle kind of censorship, I toned down my own editorial voice. I was still able to do the story of the director of prison taking bribes and giving bribes to feed inmates unedible meat substitutes. Incidentally, he has that story later hit the major media after 9 months on the Prison Show, and he has been convicted of 8 federal felonies and is awaiting sentencing now. So I was able to accomplish some good journalist purpose during that period, but I was constantly looking over my shoulder, and every time I turned on those microphones, I was careful not to offend.
Mm-hmm.
Because I didn't think station would back me up.
Hmm. Contrary to the early days.
Contrary to the Lou Hill principle that we do the hard stuff here.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm back doing the hard stuff, and I'm having a wonderful time. And I am so much more comfortable in today's atmosphere at KPFT.
Hill says there were times, however, when things looked pretty bleak.
Well, we almost lost it. I kid you not, I hope you don't mind if I call you Verna.
No, I don't mind at all.
We almost lost it. And it had relative, it, meaning the whole concept, the whole principle, the whole Lou Hill dream of Pacifica Foundation from the inception. And I don't think it had a great deal to do with KPFT. It had to do with some very valuable assets called WBAI and KPFA having frequency positions in the commercial band, and that I saw over a period of years an evolutionary movement of the structure of Pacifica decision-making process. Some of us had seen that coming for a decade. I became general manager at KPFT in 1980, and an organization called NFCB, the National Federation of Semi-Commercial Broadcasters, came into KPFT and Pacifica Life with some ideas that we would be more successful if we would homogenize our message.
Hill says the political climate in the station today is very comfortable. Now he's back doing the hard stuff and having a good time. He has some advice, however, for those in the throes of bylaws revisions.
And I would advise all of those who love Pacifica, remember that there are principles that are more important than majority vote decisions. And those principles deal with the freedoms to hear and consider minority ideas. I would much rather hear some idea on my own beloved Pacifica radio station that I absolutely oppose, so that I don't run the risk of not getting my ideas that others oppose silenced. We're in the business of making people uncomfortable, because comfortable people do not change their attitudes, do not change the things that they do. But if you're going to be an activist, and I consider myself not only an activist but an accomplished one, you're going to have to go out there and make some people uncomfortable so that they will reconsider the position they are in. And in the process, you're going to have to hear their anger and their frustration that their ideas are being challenged. But it is incumbent on Pacifica Foundation, as in no other institution that I know of, to take those ideas and make sure that we make people think about their comfortable, easy, unexamined positions, so that change can happen in a society which can only remain vital if it keeps change in frequent occurrence.
Hill, the only station founder still involved in the operations of KPFT, has very specific views on the democratization process.
I don't think that you can have a Pacifica station in Houston or Washington or New York or San Francisco or Los Angeles or wherever without depending upon the good graces and commitment of the community. But if programming becomes a process of democratic decision, so that people with minority and unpopular ideas are not heard, then we fail at the mission that Lou Hill and all of our predecessors had envisioned for us to have. For instance, I began gay and lesbian, transgendered, and bisexual programming on KPFT in 1975. If you had taken a vote of the board, local board of KPFT, they would have voted against having such a show on the air. I began doing prison program in 1980. My board, I was manager at the time, and my board told me that I shouldn't do that kind of broadcasting. We have to have the courage to protect the voices of people that are not heard at all. And that is not a process that lends itself well to a democratic decision-making process in programming.
Hill believes one of the wonderful things about Pacifica is that it can self-examine. If Pacificans cannot gather, discuss, disagree, and argue, says Hill, then we're in an unnatural state. It's those arguments, disagreements, and debates that refine our purpose and direction. And it's very healthy, he says, not just for our mission as purveyors of liberty in broadcasting, but it is important for our nation and indeed the world. WPFW 89.3 FM.
That first broadcast began significantly with Ellington's Take the A Train, and was a proud moment, a moment of great relief, it's fair to say, because of all the difficulties we'd had getting to that point.
Grigsby Hubbard, a fourth-generation Quaker, was one of the founders of the network's then only African-American managed station.
Conveyed by people who were part of that early effort, many of whom, most of whom, it's fair to say, aren't around any longer. But clearly from the beginning, there was the express purpose of bringing the Pacifica signal to this community of Washington, D.C., specifically being well aware of the need for greater expression for the African-American community. It's what figures prominently in this story is the fact that there was no black-controlled radio in the nation's capital when Pacifica began this effort. And it was very much a part of the express purpose to make it an expression of this community.
Now, when you say an expression of the community, was it to be a political expression of the community, a musical expression, a cultural expression, or what kind of expression?
Somewhat, that gets into my own notion that everything is at root political. You know, we can introduce some false dichotomies in there. It's fair to say that just in being rooted in the community and being in and of this community by the people of this community, it was very much in concert with the foundational principles of Pacifica. Every bit of the format. There was clearly an emphasis on jazz music as really the sound of the kind of radical democracy that Pacifica is about, as being a part of the mix, but the mix from the beginning to encompass everything that you hear in the eclectic Pacifica sounds elsewhere. This was the first station with an African-American manager and largely staffed by African-Americans from the very beginning and beginning in that jazz expression. But I, for one, don't appreciate the repeated implications that this is a thing apart from the kind of political expression that Pacifica is so associated with.
By the late 70s, Pacifica's reputation in Washington had preceded itself. The House Un-American Activities Committee, the Senate Internal Security Subcommittee, the FBI, the FCC were all fairly acquainted with Pacifica's politics. Just 2 years prior, the U.S. Supreme Court had heard the case against WBAI for airing comedian George Carlin's routine, Seven Dirty Words You Can't Say on Television. It was a landmark First Amendment case. Hubbard says doors were slamming in WPFW's face all over town.
There were times when it became clear that there were certain landlords who weren't going to rent to us at any price. There were a host of the kind of routine rebuffs, even beyond the, you know, the regulatory challenge, and beyond the challenge of people learning to do something they'd never done before. But there were lots of people who told us in no uncertain terms that they didn't really want us to be here. It was not just the ordinary business of putting a radio station on the air. I mean, we came to anticipate lots of people expressing the opinion that what they knew of Pacifica was not something they wanted to hear here.
It would take a 7-year struggle to get the station on the air. Hubbard was not comfortable naming businesses who blacklisted the station, even 25 years after the fact. The opposition, according to Hubbard, took on some thinly veiled tactics.
There's that story, off told, but perhaps not told enough, of how we were a part of the beginning of black radio in this town, with standing aside so that HUR could begin. Howard was literally given a station by the Washington Post Company, Kay Graham. And so that came ahead of us, and we figure prominently in all of how that came about, including contributing the first station manager there.
So was that an attempt to circumvent WPFW from coming on the air?
That's my thesis. I've expressed this before. I think clearly. And, you know, it's not something that, you know, I'm opposed to. I mean, I know the motives, but, yeah, there were lots of shifts in the whole radio market landscape that I think were directly attributable to the perceived threat of WPFW coming online.
Hubbard remembers racism as having been an obstacle from all sides, including the inside. But he's reluctant to give details, likening it to an emotional scab picking.
I've just got too many examples. These are stories that I wish the people could tell their own story. I wish I could tell the story more completely of what happened with WPFW, which I do not feel had adequate support from Pacifica from the very beginning, but that's a story more properly in the voice by the first manager, Greg Millard, who's also gone.
Hubbard says the indictment against the network is clear and extensive, but believes it's time now during the restructuring of the bylaws to be proactive. What's needed, Hubbard says, is a radical redesign that involves talking together without lapsing into shouting matches.
We can do better in the here and now, and we need to. And it's clearly the thing that gives, you know, a sense of instant renewal. I mean, people know as they've begun just in the last few months to hear more of what I think of as real Pacifica. They're just getting an appetizer, getting a taste of, you know, the reason why someone would do as I've done and just take, you know, literally years of time for something that is just strictly a volunteer effort that, you know, without any very immediate reward. But there is the immediate reward when you know that there's a possibility of people hearing the kind of programming that we get to hear now. And I'm witnessing now, of course, you know, most recently our programming heard only fitfully in Washington, D.C. on September 11th.
Grigsby Hubbard, co-founder of WPFW.
Pacifica at its worst is worth supporting. It's a unique institution, but we now face not just a special crisis, but a special time of opportunity for renewing this, really based on what it was set out to be at its foundation. And we're going to have to do this by having the crazy courage to get out of our own way and to function in a more civil way, working with one another. It's that important.
I'm Verna Avery Brown for Pacifica. Thank you for listening.
This special historic broadcast was engineered by Sidrak Franklin with technical assistance from Jim Bennett. Our music editor was Sean Rhodes. We had technical assistance from Christine Blasdale and Armundo Gedino. Many thanks to Brian DeShazer and Maria Kim in the archives. The show was co-produced by Rob Robinson and Verna Avery Brown. I am Tiffany Jordan. Thanks for listening.
Peace Watch is produced by Scott Gurian with assistance today from Reem Kadhuta. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is Granger Helvey. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Enjoy your weekend and thank you for listening.